This is the Straight Dope Podcast. Before we get started, I want to thank Mile High Shooting, Snapper's Hide, and all of you listeners that support the podcast. If you like this podcast and get stuff out of it, consider going to riflecraft.com and getting a supporter subscription. If not, hit up Mile High, thank them. They offer discounts. Email them, call them, but thank them for supporting the podcast. And if you just like to do something, but neither of those sound good to you, how about just liking, subscribing, and sharing the podcast to other people that you think might benefit from it? I know that largely all of the episodes are just my opinion, and this is no different than that. So I am going to fill in a few gaps because I don't often talk about things outside of shooting that I think come in, but those of you that do know me know I'm famous for being long-winded and trying to connect stories and stuff like that. So this is my attempt at that. Before I was born, Israel had a war, and it overlapped with what would become my birthday. But the Yom Kippur War is a conflict that I don't need to tell you about. You can go Google it if you want to. Nevertheless, during that war, my dad was riding in a Jeep. He was a paratrooper at the time, and they hit a landmine. The Jeep was thrown into the air, and everybody but him was killed, and he attributes that to not wearing his seatbelt because he was thrown from the vehicle. He did suffer some serious injuries that he recovered from and went on to continue to serve and be a part of the life that he was a part of. And I think that that is interesting. I'll get back to that point later on, maybe, gosh, close to 20 years after that. I was in a vehicle somewhere on the earth, and I got out of the vehicle before it would have killed me, probably because I wasn't wearing a seatbelt, and I was able to get out of the vehicle in time. At least that's my explanation of what happened. Maybe 10 years after that, I was wearing a seatbelt, and I was driving. If you've driven down I-80 to a shooting match, then you know what I-80 is like in Wyoming. It's a big road. There's a huge space, often filled with grass, between the lanes, and not much between them. And I was driving too fast in a snowstorm, and my truck started to slide. It was covered with snow. I was going too fast and lost traction. And despite knowing how to drive in the snow, despite knowing how to correct and do whatever it was, I just slowly drifted in my lane. And I got to about perpendicular to the direction I was traveling in. And I thought, wow, this is kind of surreal. And I drifted into the median, which was grass, but it was filled with snow. And I just continued to slide at that same rate. Drifted up into the oncoming direction of traffic. And there was traffic coming towards me. You know, on I-80, there are big trucks and so on and so forth. And there was a giant 18-wheeler coming right at me. But my truck was continuing to rotate on that drift, and it rotated parallel to the direction of traffic. And I just squeezed right between two 18-wheelers. And then my truck got some traction. I got, you know, and I drifted off to the side of the road and was on the right shoulder trying to explain or figure out what happened. I still can't explain it. Kind of dumb luck, I guess, but things could have gone much differently. My point of all these is that when we recount stories or when we recount things that happen, a lot of times, you know, we have what our experience was, and that is what it is. And was my dad saved by not wearing a seatbelt? He believes so. The thing is, if he was wearing a seatbelt, we would just never know. Right, his brothers were killed because the vehicle crushed them. But unless he actually experienced that, we really can't say anything about whether he would have been okay or not, or whether he wouldn't have got as hurt as he did. Likewise, if I was wearing a seatbelt when I had to get out of the vehicle, would I have? We'll never know, right? Unless we can go back to a parallel universe that I was wearing the seatbelt and see if I'm still around after that. And would things have gone any different? Had I done anything different when I was sliding across oncoming traffic? I'll never know. Could I replicate that if I tried? Maybe. Is it worth it? Probably not. And so it comes down to odds and how we explain things. And I think in shooting, we're doing it for fun and we are taking in our experiences. But a lot of times it comes down to, you say, well, I do it this way. And because of that, things would have gone worse or things would have gone better, right? You say, I chose to shoot this stage this way, or I chose to shoot this engagement that way. And maybe it went well and maybe it didn't. If it didn't go well, that doesn't mean the other option that you may have been considering would have worked any better. You'll just never know. So I like to coach and I like to talk about having lots of tools in the toolkit and training those things so that no matter what, if you needed to employ them, you would have experience and you'd be able to explain, when I do this, this is how it goes. When I do this, this is how it goes. And when we're training and we're preparing for all this stuff, we're learning about shooting, we're doing, there's not much to lose by trying lots of options, but sticking yourself into one path and saying, this is how I do it, this is how I'm always going to do it, and I'm never going to change it, to me seems like putting on blinders and not giving yourself the opportunity to develop a really rich and holistic understanding of what we're doing and why we do the things that we do. Now, I mention this because I've heard plenty of arguments and they're not bad, but they say, well, this is what I do and this is the best way and this is how I'm going to do it. Why would I waste my time developing skills for something that I'm not going to do? And I guess my perspective is you'll never know. And that's, how you're going to go through your life. But that's not how I go through my life. So I like to say, I can shoot off of a bag. I can shoot off a tripod. I can shoot off my bipods without a bag. I could, shoot off hand. I could shoot, whatever. And then I know how well I shoot so that I can assess whether that's something that I can actually hit or whether that's something that just simply has a probability of hit. What I mean by that is you could have a 4 MOA gun and shoot at a half MOA target at 1,000 yards and hit it, right? Because there's a chance the bullet will hit that target. Now, it probably has less to do with your skill than luck, but there is a chance that it can hit it. So having a one-hole rifle and a 4 MOA rifle doesn't mean that you can't hit a target. It just means that it's going to be less likely that you hit it three times in a row compared to one that is better. Nevertheless, when we're talking about a single instance, we can't really say much else than that's a single instance. And YouTube and all of the social media platforms are filled with videos of people golfing, people frisbee golfing, people throwing balls, people hitting baseballs, where they get a hole in one. And that's real. It really happened. Does that mean that because of that, they're going to win a green jacket or they're going to, become superstars? Probably not, right? Because it comes down to, can you do it repeatedly? Can you perform on command those tasks? And it's hard to do that. And that's why a lot of different sports, different activities get paid a lot of money when people are able to raise their percentage of performing at a certain standard. So what does this have to do with you? Well, it has to do whatever you want it to do with you. From my perspective, it's really easy to get into this versus that. And this is the way I do it because it worked for me. Or this is the way I do it because somebody told me this is the way I should do it. But when we consider that, it's usually just not true, right? Because it didn't happen. You don't have enough data. You don't have experience. You don't have something that can say, based on all of this stuff that I've done, that just doesn't perform as well for me as this. Or you tried it once and it didn't work. And you say, well, based on that one time. And often it's not really the thing that you have it labeled as, right? I think all of us have had food poisoning, and when we think about the food that we ate when we had food poisoning, you know, we're like, man, I can't eat that anymore because I got food poisoning from it. If you eat it again, are you likely going to get food poisoning? No, of course not. But you're labeling the thought of that food as the thing that gave you food poisoning. And what really gave you food poisoning was somehow a bacteria got into it while it was being made, before it was made, something like that. And you got the bacteria, not the food itself was just the food itself. The bacteria getting into it was something entirely different. Like a 4 MOA shooter missing off the right, missing off the left of a target that's 2 MOA. You can't say that the wind fucked you, right? Because you really don't know. Could it have been? Absolutely. Could it have not been? Absolutely. And until you shoot enough where you have a sample to say, all my shots are off the right side, well, now it starts to sound more like a wind issue, right? Or a zero issue or something like that. If it's one shot, it's really dangerous to take anything away from that other than, oh, well, that happened. So, which matters? Well, your perspective matters, right? Your opinion matters, but make sure that you understand what your opinion's based on and the experience that backs it up. So, what's important? That has everything to do with what you do, and I like to base it in possibility. Is it possible? Yes or no? What am I trying to accomplish? What are the goals? If I'm trying to shoot an elephant at 25 yards, do I really need to work on that one whole load? You know, probably not. But do I like it? Maybe that like outweighs everything, and I just really like making a one whole load that I'm going to shoot at 25 yards at an elephant, and I feel like that's going to do me something. That positive motivation, that desire, that belief that that is really what's going to help you actually can make a difference, right? If you think that something is possible and you truly believe in it, chances are you're going to do better at it. So there is that to be said. The other thing is it within your means? Some things are very, very expensive, or they take a ton of time, and is that time worth it to you? Some people have tons of time. Some people have unlimited amounts of money to devote to stuff, in which case, if it doesn't hurt you and you think it's good and you like it and that's what you want to do, then there's nothing wrong with that. Shit, I had an alarm go off. So I'm going to be a little bit long-winded about this because it relates to an article I just posted on Sniper's Hide and a topic that I talk about here regularly, which are these concentric circles of improvement. Every single area by itself can raise your hit probability. And it starts with that weapon inherent precision, right? A rifle without a shooter is capable of shooting a group of a particular size, right? With a maximum limit. And if I go to Cabela's, I would be willing to bet that most of those rifles are probably shooting an inch or better based on modern technology. Of course, there's rifles that have worse precision and accuracy. But nowadays, it's pretty easy for a manufacturer to build a rifle that shoots an inch or less without a shooter attached to it. Can you get a barrel and an action made or put together by a gunsmith that's much, much less than that? 100% yes. But it's going to cost you. And if you can't afford it, then maybe that's just not an option. The thing is, going from a rifle that shoots 1 inch to a half an inch statistically isn't going to have the same amount or same percentage of improvement on your hit percentage at distance if you're shooting targets that are bigger maybe than 1 MOA or 1.5 MOA. Let's say 1.5 to 2 MOA because we don't want to be right at the very limit, but a little bit bigger than that ultimate group. Thing is, you know, I can go and buy a $500, $600, $700 rifle, and I'm gonna take a chance that the group that it shoots is a little bit bigger. Could you put that one-inch gun in the hands of a very, very capable shooter and win, a national match? I think so. Yeah, if it shoots less than an inch or an inch and less, I think a good shooter could probably perform at a very, very high level. You know, if you gave a $500 barreled action to one of the Team MDT guys, my guess is they're going to get a trophy with it no matter what. Can you go spend $20,000 on a rifle? Pretty easily. Can everybody go spend $20,000 on a rifle? No, not really. So the information that people get, sometimes it's, you need to get this rifle. And it's out of their budget. And they think, well, that's the only way I'm going to be able to win. And I think largely that comes from confining yourself to a media source or source of information that gives you the impression that that's the thing that makes a difference. And I hope that this podcast gives everybody the idea that, like, there's never really one answer. And then if you keep yourself open-minded, you can find solutions that are going to help you towards your goals and be within your left and right limits of motivation, possibility, means, and so on and so forth. Going after the things that are important to you. I have expensive rifles. I have cheap rifles. But I love shooting in general, so I'm agnostic to the outlet. I love PRS. I love NRL. I love CD matches. I love sniper matches. I just love going and shooting and doing things. And probably what I love more is going to the range with Frank and saying, hey, Frank, man, I had this crazy idea. And he goes, man, let's try it. Or he goes, hey, Chris, let's try this. Dude, that sounds so awesome. Let's go try it. And we go do it. Would you ever see any of that stuff at a match? No, I've never heard of most of it at a match. Most of it's really ridiculous, but it's super fun. And it teaches us about shooting in general that can then be taken to our classes, to our coaching, to our podcast, to our articles and say, wow, this is pretty cool. It can make a difference. Will it make a difference for you? That depends on your outlet, your interest, your goals, and all things that I can't answer. It all comes down to your opinion. Ammunition is the next layer. You can take a good rifle and put in ammunition that for one reason or another, and I know there's a huge list and we can be very specific, but I'm going to be general. For one reason or another, that ammo just shoots a bigger group than something else. Ryan Steinforth was just out here and he brought me a couple of his hand loads to test in one of my rifles because we're going to shoot a team match together and I'm not set up to load. I have tons of factory ammo, but he said, hey, I load and I want to see if anything that I have shoots well. And I was like, all right, cool. I'll bring out two barrels and see what happens. So I brought out my AI, my ATX, and I brought two carbon barrels, one with a break, one with a suppressor. And I shot a five round group. I started with the break barrel and the load that he had, the 5 round group was 1/10 wide, right? Like 1/3 of an inch. And the other one was 2/10 wide, right? Like 0.75 of an inch or something like that. I know that mathematically that probably doesn't line up, but it's pretty close to those things, right? So I had a 1/10 and a 2/10. Switched the barrels and shot, and I got the exact same group pattern in reverse. The barrel that liked A shot 2/10, and in the suppressed barrel, and the other one was 1/10. And so it just kind of comes down to that. Now, is a 1/10 versus a 2/10 load going to make any difference for the things that I do? No. I could say flat out now, no, it's not going to make a difference. 1/10 is 1 mile an hour out to about 800 or 900 yards. And I can't read the wind to 1 mile an hour. And yeah, there's a chance that I could miss because of wind, because 1/10 off the plate is off the plate. 0.5 off the plate is off the plate. I think that my wind reading is, largely like a 2 to 3/10 window. So that's bigger, and therefore, to me, that means that it's probably worth investing, bringing that down before I'm worried about the difference between the load. Now, he put in the load development, so I didn't have to do it. But some people, you can imagine 200, 500, 600 rounds developing a load, and I don't want to waste barrel life, components, brass, and my time, because that would take me a year I mean, I'm not really a year, but I'm not a good loader when it comes to the development side of it. You know, I can pour in powder like the best of them, but it's just not worth my time to worry about bringing my ammo down 1/10 of group size because I don't think it's going to change my hit percentage. But I do think that wind reading can improve and will improve, and mostly because if I go somewhere that I'm not familiar with, there's always something that I learn about the wind, and then it's a little bit bigger than that. So that tends to captivate my interest, and then it comes back to the, do I like it? Am I motivated? And I like and I am motivated about studying that stuff. And I don't like and I'm not motivated by bringing my group size down 1/10, right? Now, to me, the biggest addition of error, aside from the wind, is shooter fundamentals. Shooter fundamentals can be a massive increase in your group size. And the data that I have on Riflecraft, it's settled in about 3.5 inches. So if somebody's going to shoot the 12 shots from the four positions, those groups are often about 3.5 inches from your point of aim. So I'm not saying that you couldn't shoot a smaller group, but considering that you're trying to hit something at the center of the target, it's going to be about 3.5 inches from the center of the target. And so that kind of dwarfs all those other components. And until you get a grip on consistent applied fundamentals, I think it's well worth understanding what your influence on the system is, because the system isn't doing that, right? We are. And so most people I advise, and there's not a straightforward answer. And I don't tell people, you know, do it this way, because I also don't subscribe to the philosophy that there's one way to do it. Yeah, we could say 90-degree trigger pull and shoot at your respiratory pause and bridge so that you can manage the recoil, or something's going to have to manage recoil. And all of those fundamentals, yeah, they exist. I shoot with my middle finger. And I run the bolt, you know, depending on the rifle and depending on the side that I'm shooting it on, with different hands. I hold it different. I do all sorts of different things. But when I pull back on the trigger, yeah, I try to pull straight back. You want to try to pull straight back because you don't want to pull your rifle off its point of aim. And, you know, there are a lot of things that have left and right limits. But really, it's pretty hard to make your group open up with a heavy competition rifle, no matter how you pull the trigger. Does it matter for you? I don't know. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But if you're focusing on something that has a positive outcome, maybe it's just simply the sake of focusing on that keeps you from doing the other things that opens up your group. And in which case, that's pretty cool. It's still fun to say, by focusing on something, it's keeping me from doing something else that has a worse effect. So is it the 90-degree trigger pull that really fixed your group? It might not be, right? It might be the fact that by focusing, you're not letting yourself subconsciously or inadvertently doing something else that then, you know, if you're not focusing on the trigger, maybe you're worried about the noise that's going to happen when the primer gets struck, and you'll flinch, or you squeeze too hard, or you push too hard, because now instead of focusing on the trigger, you're focusing on something that then you add too much input to. So it's not that straightforward. It's you know, I like the constraints, right? There's multiple constraints, and we're trying to say, hey, look, you know, let's manage and understand all of these constraints and change and mix them and understand so that we have an authentic understanding of the things that we're doing. And then stress, right? If we're shooting a match, there's a clock. And if there's a clock, there's going to be a reaction that we have. And good shooters have inoculated themselves to the stress of a clock better than somebody who hasn't. But that stress is going to open up your group. If you haven't trained under stress or under time, you don't know what the effects are. And so doing some sort of a stress test, but if the stress is always the same, you'll get used to it. And that's great if you're going to a competition where it's mimicking that particular stress. But there are lots of ways to stress somebody, and each one's going to have a different effect. So if you're really good with a clock, that doesn't mean you're going to be good if a working dog is running at you, right? Or you know, something else is happening. You need to change the stressors to see if you can manage those things under multiple constraints. Because, right, at a sniper match, one of the cool things that I like about those is you don't know what the stressor is going to be. So when you show up to a stage, It could be a stressor that you're not ready for, in which case it's going to cause you to miss a shot, not because you can't shoot, but because under those conditions, your shooter bracket opens up beyond the parameters of the target, and, you know, push comes to shove, you miss or you hit, and that's how things roll forward. So the shooter fundamentals can be divided into two parts, right? The I'm training fundamental, and then I'm a stressed fundamental, and those are different. And I think it's really important to think about them separately and not just train under stress and not just train the same stress, but to go back and forth. Now, I don't advocate always doing it under stress, because you can develop a lot of bad habits if you don't manage it correctly, but doing it so that you have an understanding of, okay, under this stress, this is how I perform. Then you go back to the drawing board and you work on the things, you know, in a more controlled manner than just constantly freaking yourself out. Yeah, right, that's good. But I also don't advocate people train on the craft drill or the craft target. I think it's an assessment that you do at a series of time points, you know, whether it's, if you're training, if you do it once a week, once a month, every other month, you're basically taking a snapshot of your fundamentals. And in between, you're going to be working on stuff. You're going to be doing something that ideally, after that period of time, you'll have embodied and changed the capability, and then you'll be able to measure it afterwards. But if you're just doing it to train, you're kind of training for a test, and that's not the idea. The idea is it's a test to see how your training is doing. And so That's where I stand with that. Have people trained with the craft drill or the craft challenge and gotten better? 100%, right? Well, not 100%. 100%, yeah, like, not 100%. God, I keep saying that. Absolutely. I've got lots of messages of folks like, hey, man, I did this for every day for a week and I got a trophy. And, or every day for a month, or every day for 2 months, or every day for 3 months, and I got a trophy. But the thing is, you know, you're kind of reinforcing four positions, and those four positions are likely the same height, the same prop, the same thing, in which case you're getting more fine-tuned and more specialized for those particular heights, for those particular props. And I don't like that in the big picture of growth and development, because you don't want to be fixed to that height, right? You want to be adaptable to any height. You want to be adaptable to any stress, any distance, any rifle, any, and that's my personal philosophy that I champion on this podcast, is it's fine if you have one outlet and one thing that you do, but to get better and get well-rounded, you definitely want to keep in mind that you don't want to set yourself limitations that could hold you back in the future. So all heights are important. Do I think you assess yourself at all heights? Well, that takes a lot of rounds. And the initial craft drill was 30 shots. And people said, man, I think we're going to get the same picture if you do 12 shots. And I also did it at 10 heights, not four. And at the same token, I'll do four positions, but they won't be the same number of inches off the ground. And most of the time, I do it on a tripod. But I do clipped in, I do it with a bag, but I make sure that the height of the tripod is different. The legs are in different positions. The legs are in different orientations. I'm always changing those constraints to make sure that it's not me training for the test, but it's me developing my fundamentals so that if I don't have that tripod or bag, but something is a particular height, I intuitively know how to adapt to that height and maintain point of impact, point of aim, and a group size that's appropriate for whatever that target is. And I make that determination by knowing my bracket size so that when the reticle marries up against the target, it tells me, is this a shot that I can make, or is this a shot that is only a statistical probability? And I get it. Like, it's all a statistical probability. But if your group is 1 inch and you're shooting at a 2 inch target, I call that like a shot you can take. If the group is 1 inch and you're shooting at a 1 inch target, I still consider that a shot that you can take. But if your group is 1 inch and you're shooting at a half inch target, I call that a statistical probability, right? If you take one shot, you might hit it and you might not, but you won't be able to tell me why you missed it, right? Except if the answer is my shooter bracket's an inch and it was half an inch and I got lucky, right? That's about the only thing we could say with certainty. So breaking apart and studying those rings that You know, and then somebody else pointed out that they read the article and they said, you know, I really like it. And it's basically reinforcing the idea that errors compound, errors stack, things get bigger. But where they come from are different things that we can kind of separate and address. And I think that the whole point of this podcast is keeping an open mind and making sure that as you hash out and address those things that you want to work on, you understand how much it's going to improve you, and you marry that up to your goals of, do I like this? Is this important to me? Is it within my means? Is it possible? Is it probable? Is it important to me? And if the answer is yes to all those, then it's a good idea to do it. And just because something works doesn't mean that that's the only thing that's going to work, right? Just because my dad and I were not wearing seatbelts at one point in our lives doesn't mean that it's a good idea to not wear it, or it doesn't mean that one won't save our lives in the future. It means that you need to understand that a positive result doesn't mean it's always going to be a positive result. And a negative result doesn't really mean it's negative, right? It means that it's telling you something that you need to keep an open mind to. And I like the idea of the positive growth. Let's build out the left and right limits. Let's understand this. Let's appreciate it. Because really, it's an art that is just so rich and deep that no matter where you go, you could probably spend the rest of your life appreciating nuances and more, you know, developing understanding. And by doing that, we might be able to push that front of where the limits of performance forward in a direction and in an area and an outlet that we're a part of and that we love. And that would be pretty cool. And also, like, if we are at the front, you don't want to say, well, I'm at the front, you know, I'm winning all these matches and I'm doing the things and there's nobody better than me. I can't get any better. That's totally wrong. We can always get better. And we get better by pushing the limits, by keeping an open mind, by accepting that so much is possible and that we're the sources of our own limitations. So make sure that the message comes across that we are our own worst enemy at times if we're not working hard to make sure that we're not our worst enemy, right? Or we're not, gosh, that doesn't sound right. Anyway, you're going to laugh at this, but you get what I'm trying to say. A lot of what holds us back is us. And a lot of what holds us back in us is believing things that probably aren't true based on small sample sizes or things that we don't have direct experience with. So for what it's worth, this is whatever episode this turns out to be. And if you like this, have thoughts, want to talk about it, email chris@riflecraft.com or hit me up on Instagram @gunaroundthesun. Hit me up on Facebook and share it if you like it. I would love to hear from you. I hear from lots of people, but I'd love to hear from more. Again, if you want to support the podcast, you can subscribe and you can hit up Mile High and you can hit up Sniper's Hide and you can do all these things. And probably most importantly, just keep listening, share it with your friends and grow the community of people that are trying to just get better at the thing that we love. So be a good person, be there for your friends, be there for yourself. And see you next time.